The following lecture was delivered at the 17th Annual National Jewish Retreat in Palm Desert, California, a project of the Rohr Jewish Learning Institute. We hope you enjoy it. We encourage you to visit jretreat.com for information on upcoming retreats. Rabbi Manas Friedman now presents his lecture, The Rebbe, You and Me.
We've been blessed as a people throughout our history. We've always had great inspired leaders. We're reading now the fifth book of the Torah, Devarim, which is very different from the first four. Because in the fifth book, everything is said in Moshe's voice. It's not God said to Moshe. It's Moshe said, God told me. Moshe is speaking. Why would that be? Some people might think, well, it's the fifth book, there wasn't much left for God to say, so Moshe kind of filled in. So it's not quite as holy, God forbid, or whatever. Of course, the opposite is true. After four books of Torah and all that it contains and describes, and all the experiences of the 40 years in the desert, godliness had become much more familiar. It had come down to earth. And now when Moshe spoke, he didn't have to quote. He didn't have to say, this is what God said. We knew. Whatever Moshe says, it's what God is saying. That's what Moshe is. Moshe's entire existence, his entire being, was God's voice. God speaks to us through Moshe. So in the beginning, he had to quote. He had to say, God told me, God said, listen to this, God just asked us to do another mitzvah. But by the fifth book, after 40 years, when you attain a certain degree of maturity and wisdom, he didn't have to do that anymore. Moshe was God's voice. He didn't have to keep attributing everything he said to God. We also know that every generation has the Moshe of the generation. A generation doesn't mean 50 years or 100 years. It means as needed. We've always had a Moshe figure to lead us through whatever was going on in our history. One of the most powerful examples is Mordechai. When Jews were in very different circumstances, didn't know how to handle it, exiled from their land, they needed not just good advice, they needed divine instruction. What does God want of us under these circumstances? Mordechai was there to tell us. So in every generation, God has a voice. Of course, to some degree, every genuine scholar in Torah is speaking in God's name. But they should be attributing and quoting, because we might not know that they're speaking in God's name. But there's one individual in every generation who doesn't have to quote. He is God's voice for the entire generation. The Rebbe exceeded even that, because the Rebbe combined a number of functions that we don't usually find all in one person. There was a reporter back in the 60s who came to Crown Heights, interviewed a lot of people, spoke with a lot of people, and wrote a very nice article. And one of the most salient points was that she found the community very open. People were very willing to speak, to share. Every question she asked was answered, except for one thing. She noticed that when she asked people, and she asked many people, what is your relationship with the Rebbe? All of a sudden, they became vague. All of a sudden, they were reticent. They didn't want to talk about it. And that makes her a little suspicious, like, what's going on over here? What is the secret here? The secret, of course, is that people's relationship with the Rebbe was so private. It was so personal. They couldn't speak of the Rebbe in the abstract, in generalities. So what were they going to say? When I was in trouble and I was very worried and I wrote to the Rebbe and he reassured me, and it gets so personal. So they became vague. I mean, somebody stops you and says, how's your love life? I mean, you're not going to be willing to talk about it. It's personal. So there is that relationship, that aspect of the Rebbe's function, that it was very personal with everyone he met. Even if it was for a moment. You know, people would line up for dollars every Sunday, and the Rebbe would give everybody a dollar and a good wish, a blessing, and they would make eye contact for literally seconds before moving on. And people walked away saying, the Rebbe really saw me. There was something personal. On the other hand, the Rebbe was much more than the leader or teacher of Crown Heights or of Chabad Hasidim. He was a universal leader, global. There was nothing going on in the Jewish world that the Rebbe was not concerned about, was not involved in, was not guiding, correcting. Just a little example without getting into different subjects. The Six-Day War. Israel took the initiative and did a preemptive strike, and the victory was incredible. The Rebbe was behind that. The Rebbe urged them, demanded that they take a preemptive strike. There's hardly any major event in Jewish life that the Rebbe was not involved in. These two sides of a personality don't usually come together. If you're global, if you think cosmic, if you think universal, you don't have that kind of personality that can establish an intimate connection in seconds with everyone you meet. That's a completely different mentality. So someone asked one of the wise older Hasidim in the beginning of the Rebbe's leadership. Somebody asked him, how come you venerate the Rebbe? I mean, we have big rabbis, we have heads of academies, of yeshivas, Rosh yeshivas, great scholars, and we respect them, but you venerate the Rebbe like too much. Why is that? And he said very correctly, I think, in your life, if you need information on Judaism, you go to the Talmud Chacham, you go to the rabbi. If you need advice on medical things, you go to a doctor. If you need advice on financial things, you go to an accountant, et cetera, et cetera. By us, so you spread your respect over many people. By us, the Rebbe is all of that. So he gets the admiration and the veneration that you would spread over 5 or 6 people. He gets it all. In other words, he does it all, so he deserves that kind of respect. The global aspect, the cosmic aspect. There was an incident, anti-Semitic incident, violent. And the Chabad rabbi, who was the victim of it, told the press, the Jewish traditional response to evil is to increase the good, and that's what we're going to do. We're going to do more projects, we're going to have more mitzvahs, we're going to do more charity. That's the Jewish response to evil. It was a big hit. That was quoted over and over again. But it turns out it's not true. It's not at all true. Think of Jewish history. When did we ever respond to evil by doing more mitzvahs? Never. We either responded by going to war against the evil, like on Purim, Hanukkah, or we went along with it. We bowed our heads and waited for it to pass. There was never a response. Oh, you're going to be evil? Well, I'm going to be good. I'm going to be better. I'm going to do more good. Never. This is the Rebbe's innovation. The Rebbe introduced this idea that when something negative happens, we do more good. Why the change? Because something cosmic changed. The evil that used to exist had to be destroyed. You had to fight it or ignore it or resist it because it was, let's say, substantial evil. Like the Nazis. Communism. It had to be destroyed. The evil that exists today is different. There's darkness, like the darkness in Egypt, that is tangible. It's a creation, the creation of darkness, and that has to be destroyed. But then there's darkness that is simply the absence of light. If there's no light, then there's dark. What is the solution? Well, turn on the light. If you go to war against darkness that is only the absence of light, you're fighting a ghost. You're giving it too much credit, too much significance. Is the wrong response. Turn on the light. Maybe a quick example. I'm at a dinner, cocktail party, something for a fundraiser, crowded room, and a woman comes up behind me and in a shrill voice says, Rebbe, my son is marrying a non-Jew. Talk to him. The whole room heard it. Everybody turned around. Her son was standing right behind me. And I thought, this poor guy must be so embarrassed. But he wasn't. He was just standing there calmly. So I said, you're marrying a non-Jew? He says, yeah. I said, so you're going to be the Jew in the family? He says, yeah. I said, so if they have any questions, you'll answer and explain. He says, yeah, I guess so. I said, do you think you know enough to be able to answer the questions? He says, what is there to know? And he was completely sincere. I said, what is there to know? 5 books of Moses, 22 books of the prophets, 60 volumes of the Talmud, and about 1,000 customs. He says, oh, just like that. I said, you know what would be a good idea? The wedding isn't until whatever, 6 months later. I said, why don't you take a month, go off to yeshiva, learn a little bit, so that when your family will ask you questions on Judaism, you'll be able to answer like a mensch. He says, that's a great idea. He went off to yeshiva and found out that it wasn't a great idea. A generation ago, when someone married a non-Jew, the family sat shiva. Now, that joke about a Jewish boy who brings home an Indian girlfriend and says, Ma, this is the girl I'm going to marry. She is running deer. The mother says, hi, how are you? I'm sitting shiva. That's what it used to be. Because if your child married out, it meant that he doesn't want to be part of the community, he doesn't want to be Jewish, he doesn't want to have anything to, and you're not going to see him again. So you sat shiva. It's not the same today. We have a session for teenage girls a few weeks ago. So many of them have non-Jewish fathers. And where do they spend their summer? Beis Chana. It's not the same. So what happened is that something changed in the cosmic character of darkness and evil. It's all emptiness. If you want to describe the problems of today, it's not so much evil as it is confusion, uncertainty, anxiety, because we just don't know. We don't know. We don't know what it means to be a man. We don't know what it means to be a woman. We don't know what it means to be a Jew. We don't know what it means to be a human being. We don't know. So, in the confusion, all sorts of strange things can happen. Who among us would be aware of this shift, of this change in the nature of evil? Of course, the Rebbe felt it immediately. And he said, this is a different time. Sure, communism has to be defeated. But that's not our big problem anymore, even while communism still existed. The big problem of our time, I don't know if you can call it a generation, it's simply absence of light. We just don't know. It's been too long. So the Rebbe was the voice of God for our generation in this particular instance and in many other issues that traditional Judaism had never faced. Challenges, questions, issues. The Rebbe clued us in. When the Rebbe started this idea of inspiring others, introducing others to mitzvahs, people didn't understand that this was never done before. Never. If someone doesn't grow up religious, doesn't grow up observant, doesn't grow up with the knowledge of Torah, they were dismissed. They don't count. No one ever thought to do outreach. When the Rebbe introduced it, the observant world, the traditional world of Judaism, was horrified. What are you doing? Why are you talking to them? They will confuse you. You're going to end up being less observant. They're not going to become more observant. That never happens. And the Rebbe said, that's how it used to be. Hermann Wouk, the famous writer, visited with the Rebbe back in the 50s. He was very surprised that the Rebbe was familiar with his books. Are you familiar with his books? Marjorie Morningstar? His other books are about war, but Marjorie Morningstar was just a novel. He was shocked that the Rebbe had read it and had some criticism. But in that conversation, Wouk said to the Rebbe, you know, this is America. This is not Europe. Here, you can't tell anyone to do anything. So Judaism is not going to work here. And the Rebbe said, you're right. You can't tell anyone to do anything, but if you teach them in America, you can do everything. It's a new time. It was a radical change in thinking, in attitude, in Torah. As it turns out, the Rebbe was right. People want to be more observant. Jews want to be better Jews. They just need the information. The most amazing part of our relationship with the Rebbe is also in the nature of the righteous, the holy, the tzaddik. There are different tzaddikim. Generally, we think of a tzaddik as someone who happens to walk on earth, but his head, his mind, his soul, they're in heaven. He's thinking heavenly, he's focused on heavenly. The earth and all of its pleasures don't interest him. He's a holy person. Isn't that what holy means? Holy means detached, separated, set apart. And we respect that. We're in awe of that. But then there are these rare tzaddikim who are called shepherds. Their commitment is to the people. Their commitment is to what's going on in the world and making the world a better place. So even though their soul might be in heaven, their focus is on earth. The famous Reb Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, whose love for his fellow Jew was infinite, he promised before he passed away that he would not enter heaven, he would not go into Gan Eden until Mashiach comes and liberates the world. That'll be his protest. He will refuse to go into Gan Eden, demanding that Mashiach come. That was a long time ago. So we're told that although he had promised not to go into Gan Eden, when he was standing near Gan Eden and he heard what was going on inside, he couldn't resist and he gave in and he went into Gan Eden. But the Rebbe also said that he will not go into Gan Eden until Mashiach comes. Only with the Rebbe, it's different. The Berdichev, while he was alive on earth, lived in heaven. His pleasure was only the pleasure of godliness. He was a soul walking around on earth. And a soul, a godly soul, enjoys godliness. The rest of this world didn't interest him at all. So when he got close to heaven, that had been his pleasure and his passion all his life. So, of course, it was irresistible. That's what he lived for. How could he resist it? With the Rebbe, it's not that way at all. The Rebbe was never interested in heaven. He was interested in earth. What's going on with this world, with God's creation? How do we make it holier? How do we make it better? How do we make it more comfortable for the Creator? So when he said he won't go into heaven, into Gan Eden, until Mashiach comes, it's not a sacrifice for him. He's not tempted by heaven, and he has to resist. Heaven doesn't interest him. So even today, after the Rebbe passed away, his devotion, his concern, his attention, his focus is on earth. He's still concerned with, are there more people doing mitzvahs now? Is there some way we can inspire a few more people? And if all Jews are already inspired, well, how about non-Jews? You've heard of them, right? There are only 7 billion of them. How do we inspire them? That's always been the Rebbe's passion. Why would it change? So if you go to the Rebbe's resting place today, it's different than going to Israel, to Hebron, to Ma'aretz HaMachpelah. Awesome, awesome experience. This is where Avraham and Sarah are buried, Yitzchak and Rivka, Yaakov and Leah, Adam and Eve. That's real freaky. You're standing by the grave of Adam and Chava. Who were they? What were they? Avraham and Sarah, pretty much like your grandfather and grandmother. But Adam and Chava? So it's awesome. But it's not like going to the Rebbe. Avraham feels some kinship with every Jew. He was the first Jew. He's our father. Sarah, our first mother. But that was a long time ago. I know the names of all of my children. I really do. In fact, I know the names of my grandchildren. Great-grandchildren, I'm a little hazy there. Their names, their birthdays, maybe because old age, or because it's 3 generations removed, it doesn't register the way children and grandchildren do. So Avraham and Sarah, it's been 4,000 years that they have been in heaven. And we come to them and say, you know, we have some problems, financial. They don't know what you're talking about. That's a problem? What kind of problem is that? But when you come to the Rebbe, nothing has changed. He always was and still is interested only in what's going on with God's creation. And not surprisingly, that's what God is concerned with. What does God think about? What's going on in heaven? Not really. God is concerned with what's going on with earth. As we see in the Torah, in the beginning, God created heaven and earth. And that's the last time heaven is mentioned. Everything else is about earth. So if you get a chance and you go to the Rebbe's resting place, you're talking not to an ancient soul who is in heaven. You're talking about a soul who is very much on earth, concerned, dedicated, devoted to what's going on earth. If you tell him good news, you make his day, whatever a day is up there. And if there's bad news, he's concerned. He hears it, he understands it, he relates to it. So the miracles that happen there daily are just incredible. So that's another aspect of the Rebbe that makes him different from other holy people. The Rebbe's view of humanity is still something we don't completely understand and needs a lot more study. The Rebbe saw potential in human beings that no therapist, no psychiatrist, no psychoanalyst ever dreamed. The Rebbe could bring out abilities, talents in people who you would never think, you would never believe. Like the shluchim all over the world. We were in school together. Nothing special. They're not gifted people. But the Rebbe saw something. The Rebbe saw a potential that no one else saw. And it's not miraculous. It is human nature. But there's so much of our nature that we haven't mined. We haven't discovered. We haven't dug it up. The Rebbe saw it and brought it out. One of the things that's relevant and important, Every therapist, from Freud down to today, is very familiar and has great insight into human need. Freud said you need pleasure. Adler said you need power. Maslow says you need a whole bunch of things. Everybody had their insight into our needs. The Rebbe had a deeper insight. All of our needs, as real as they are not true. Human beings don't have needs. It's a false description of a human being. If you say, oh look, I'm just a human being, what does it usually mean? It means I have to eat, I have to sleep, because I'm a human being. I also have problems, I have worries, I need friends, I need support, I need protection, I need security. Why? Hey, I'm a human being. That's not a human being. It's not. First of all, every one of those things is true of animals. They need to eat, they need to drink, they need security, they need freedom, they need support. There's nothing human about it. So when you say, I'm a human being, I need to eat, wrong. Eating doesn't make you human. Eating interferes with your humanity. You're busy doing great things, like we can sit here and talk about the Rebbe for 5 hours. Now we have to take a break for lunch because we're human. No, because we're human, we should sit here and talk about the Rebbe for 5 hours. But because we're also a little bit of an animal, we're going to have to eat lunch. But we don't have to take that so seriously. That's not what makes us human. Do human beings really have needs? Listen to this shocking revelation. When human beings have needs, it disturbs the human spirit. The reason we suffer from our needs is because we shouldn't have them. Human beings should be involved all the time with purely human activity, Why are we eating and sleeping and doing the things that animals do, plants do? Okay, we have no choice. If you want to live, you have to eat and drink and sleep. We have no choice, but we don't like it. It doesn't enhance our lives. It doesn't support what we're all about. It doesn't make us human. So the human side of us feels uncomfortable and objects to having those needs. It's embarrassing too. What does it mean we have to eat? That's so embarrassing. You have to sleep? Oh, I know the benefits of good sleep. But what kind of handicap is that? I can't function without 8 hours of sleep? Who did this to me? So when I'm in the right frame of mind, I resent the fact that I need to sleep. And very often I resent the fact that I need to eat. It's not something to be proud of. So, correctly speaking, I shouldn't call it my need. I need to eat. Come on, don't reduce me to that. That's embarrassing. I have a handicap. I can't go for more than 3 hours without food. I didn't ask for this. It wasn't my choice, wasn't my decision. I don't even agree with it. Why can't we just eat when we're in the mood? Like something really special and tasty once a week. Okay, we'll eat a... Why this handicap, this enslavement? Can't function without food? That's so embarrassing. So the very fact that we have needs is unnatural. Isn't that amazing? All of our needs have always been driven by survival. You have to eat, stay alive. You have to sleep, stay alive. You need protection, stay alive. Now we stop and think for a moment and say, excuse me, but do I really need to live? I mean, I don't mind. I'm not suicidal. But do I need to live? I don't think so. Did anyone ever complain to you that they weren't born? If you're not born, you're not born. It's not a problem. Problems begin when you are born. So it turns out, this is the proper definition of a human being. We are here to serve a purpose. We don't need this. It's not our purpose. We're not here to take care of ourselves. We're not here to be the most you can be. We're not here to get the most pleasure out of life. It's not true. It's not true. And this is not mystical or spiritual or holy. This is just human nature. Human beings, unlike animals, have a purpose. That's human. The rest is interference. So if you want to describe a human being, don't say, a human being has to eat and drink. That's describing the animal. So if somebody says, so are you keeping Shabbos now? Why? Oh, you're keeping kosher now? Why? Your answer should be, because I'm a human being. I'm a human being. I was created for a purpose, and this is my purpose. Do I also eat? If God wants me to eat, I'll eat. If that's part of the purpose, fine. But what makes me human? Kosher, Shabbos, tzedakah, that's human. Eating and drinking, that's animal. The Rebbe saw this in us. And so he took teenage boys and girls and said, there is a purpose. Get ready to serve the purpose. Go dedicate yourself to a Jewish community. Teach somebody. Teach everybody. Be a human being. So, in the early years, Shluchim went off to places where they had nothing to eat. There was no kosher food. Sometimes there was no food at all, like in Siberia. And where are we going to get money if we go off on these missions? The Rebbe said, I don't know. Figure it out. So no money, no food, no friends, no safety, no support. And they went. Young couples. Because eating, drinking, money, support, that's not what makes you a mensch. The mensch is the mission. You are a purposeful creature, not a needy, dependent creature who can't go without food and sleep. That was something fascinating that is still not well understood. How did the Rebbe do that? How did the Rebbe turn ordinary young men and women into extraordinary servants of the people? There are shluchim who all they ever studied was Torah. But when there's a flood, when there's an earthquake, when there's a disaster, they are first responders. They're there before the official organizations. They've already got a helicopter delivering food. They've already got boats out picking up people. They've already stocked food for. Where did they learn to do this? They didn't. They're there to serve. And if this is what it takes to serve, so they serve. They can serve you cholent, or they'll serve you a helicopter to drag you out of the flood. It's unprecedented. This has never happened before in history. How did the Rebbe do this? He saw in us the potential that is true. It's just closer to the truth. As you get closer to the truth, you have fewer limitations, you have fewer handicaps, you have far greater influence than you ever thought. And this is how we get the world ready for Mashiach. So the Rebbe's insistence on bringing Mashiach is very much part of the character. He saw the potential in the world. He's concerned with making the world holy. He saw the potential in people. What does that add up to? If everyone reaches their potential, Mashiach will be here. It's all very consistent. And none of it is mystical. None of it is spiritual. It's the treasures that God created in this seemingly low world. Our job is to simply reveal it. And the Rebbe, he was the pioneer. He saw it, he revealed it, he introduced it, and he gave us the ability to live up to it. This is the Rebbe. People say, I wish I had seen the Rebbe. I miss the Rebbe. A young girl said, oh, I miss the Rebbe. I said, what do you mean you miss the Rebbe? You never saw the Rebbe. She says, right. Never saw him. But I miss him. That is something really quite unusual. So if you get a chance to visit the other coast, if you're ever there or if you have a need, go to the Rebbe. He's there for you as much today as ever, and in some ways even more. Because as we get closer to Mashiach, the excitement builds. Heaven becomes less interesting every passing day. Earth becomes more interesting every passing day. And if we have a chance, we'll talk about how the world has become so much better right under our noses, and we didn't notice. Thank you.
Please visit myjli.com to learn more about JLI's multiple educational offerings.